It's 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California, January 23rd, 2010. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. It's time now, of course, for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridges and gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. The geeks today are Miles Elam. He's a slacker and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We have Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe's a freelance media guy.
Hello.
And, yeah, good morning. And we also have Al Luckow, and Al Luckow is a new media architect. Morning.
Hello, everybody.
And Al, the theme today?
In our quest for trying out different types of themes for our show, this today's theme was by Dave Porterra, a former Atari developer.
Oh, he was. So that's
he was actually in one of the Atari games, and it slips my mind. He, you know, he did a lot of the rotoscoping, and he was actually like a guy. Like,
you know, did he do the music?
He did just all sorts of stuff.
Well, he's the guy that's in one of the fight games in the background.
What's it called? I forgot.
Classic
now.
Fight game. Like Miles, the classic fight game. Like Street. Not it's not Street Fighter. It's like in the same genre.
And there were two.
It's got a whole bunch of rotoscoping of like video. It's almost like video type work in the background.
Yeah, there were two of them. There was like a Street Fighter one or two. Anyway, he's one of the like background guys. You know, they
Miles classic fighting game.
I can think of several.
Let's hear it.
Kung Fu.
No.
Atari. That's the thing, though. I don't know
not
which
Atari,
ones are
though.
Specifically.
It was at the arcade. It wasn't like
yes.
this.
Are you talking about an Atari 2600 game?
No, at the arcade.
At the arcade only.
Yeah.
Punch-Out?
No.
I think
good.
It's
Punch-Out's
Street Fighter or something.
It's not Street Fighter. It's like right in that genre. Yeah. It's a little bit after that. It's got a lot more gore. It was actually a setting where blood would fly all over the place.
Mortal Kombat?
Thank you, Mortal Kombat.
Mortal
that's
Kombat.
The one.
Might have been that one.
I think
yeah.
that's one, yeah.
So.
That wasn't available for the Atari, was it?
No, but it was Atari's game made
right.
for their console systems.
Got it.
Yeah, I don't think Atari would have had enough power to do it.
So that's why I was confused, going like, I know. Thinking of Atari 2600 games?
I knew that was leading you astray, Miles.
Anyway, he's the guy that did that song.
That theme song.
And Dave Porterra.
We are accepting any theme song submissions you'd like. We might not play them. We might play them, depending on if we dig them or not. I think we've got another one in the works that we're like, it's cool, but it just needs a little more something. So anyway, we'll see how that goes. And if you'd like to participate by submitting a theme song, and please feel free to do one without modem sounds if you want. Even a classic, riff on a guitar might work. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to have an electronic sound to it, though we are a geeky show. And since we're a geeky show, let's start with the geeky news. I'm going to start with Google Gravity, this great actually, it's the whole Chrome experiments. Google Chrome is a new browser. It's available on all operating systems by Google. And it has really great performance for JavaScript. It also has all the advanced features of CSS, the newer stuff that's actually not available for Firefox even. And Safari and Google Chrome both use the WebKit engine. They have the same engine. And one of the things, they support the new HTML5 stuff, which means the canvas tag, the video tag, kind of like there's an image tag, but there's a video tag. Anyway, there's more features in the browser, so you can do things that are really cool. And one of the things you can do is rotate CSS objects, rotate div objects, or HTML objects, excuse me. And that might not sound that exciting to me, but exciting to you, but imagine a search bar on a site being vertical, and you put your mouse into it and type, and your text goes vertical, for example. That might be a useful design concept that Al, you'd use in your new media architecture.
Yeah, it'd be good for like making sort of like totem poles
writing. Of text.
So you could have a totem pole and write on it.
Well, I was thinking the search bar always takes up a lot of space, right? And you could put it vertical as a separator.
Yeah, it'd be nice if you had a field like that, and it was on like on the right side, and since you touched it, it flipped.
Yeah,
flip the
exactly.
right side.
Yeah, rotate
like
it around.
Yeah,
you can
out.
Do that
yeah.
kind of stuff too. Mm-hmm. Even in CSS, you can hover state with a
rotation. You have a Swiss Army knife website.
I want one.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the examples is this great gravity of Google. So it's a Google web page, and it does something kind of fun. But you have to have Safari or Google Chrome, which, of course, is a free download. So Safari on Windows and Mac. And that's the first news story on our site. We're actually doing our news today in order on the website. So if you want to follow along, you can, assuming we actually turn the show on live, which we haven't done yet. All right. So the next person up would be Al. What's going on with YouTube?
Oh, YouTube is going to start charging $5 for some videos. And it's this week they're seeing if people are going to be into paying $5. And the videos that they're talking about happen to be Sundance Film Festival independent films. So they say they're giving the lion's share of the money to the independent filmmaker. But, you know, you're able to go in there and watch the thing. And they want to see if people are going to be willing to pay, you know, $5 to watch one of these films.
Are these things any good?
Well, they're Sundance films, so they are independent films, and they're of the quality that those films are. A lot of them are really groundbreaking, and a lot of them are just kind of eh, you know. So
yeah.
I think that the one thing that makes me wonder is, can you watch it once, or can I invite 500 of my friends over to my basement and we all watch it once, or can I watch it three times, or how do I pay it? You know, well, it's probably Google checkout. Probably.
Right.
And then, you know, is it an account or can you, you know, so I don't know.
It's not for everything. It's just for these special films. And it makes sense that YouTube would be a place to find videos because it's such a well-known place to find videos. And that's probably why Sundance is doing it.
Are there any places that you actually do pay to watch a video online?
Sure.
Like what?
I don't know. But they are.
I mean.
I'll put videos up if you pay me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little, well, aside from the obvious, but. Yeah, interesting though. So, to see people pay for that.
Yeah, that's kind of a short story. So I'm gonna give you another one. What's going on with Bill Gates?
Bill Gates has a blog.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, actually, he's just a guy. Apparently, just your average
CEO
guy.
Anymore.
He's not anything special now.
Your average multi-billionaire.
Yeah, he's just the right. You know, you might see him at the Ace Hardware buying light bulbs or something. So he decided.
So what does he write about? What does he riff about?
Well, it's called Gates Notes, and apparently,
is this about San Francisco.
Apparently, that he writes things that are he does it anyway. He makes a letter to investors. He makes an annual letter where he indicates his thoughts on, you know, what's going on with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and stuff like that. So they're taking all these things that he writes anyway, and they're sticking him in the blog. I find it hard to believe he's, you know, staying up late. In the, you know, light of his computer, thinking up things to type into his blog and Twitter. He's got a Twitter thing, too. He's got, like, a little link to a Twitter account there. So, you know, if you're a Gates guy.
If you're into that kind of thing.
It does have, you know, it's called thegatesnotes.com. And it does have content there. I mean, I'm sure it's high quality. The site looks very nice. So, you know, it's as worthy as anything else.
You should buy the domain Gates Notes instead of the Gates Notes.
Yeah.
He has enough money to do that.
You
think
so?
Yeah.
I think he probably could buy anything he wants.
Of all the people, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the Gates Notes Central. So, you know, every time you try to buy a domain, it's like, that's not available, but that name, and then they tack on the word Central.
Central or online.
Yeah,
Or live.
That's only 75 letters. I'm sure people can remember that.
Miles, what's going on with CBS and Jack Benny?
Oh, you're jumping around. You're catching me off guard here.
What? It's in order that way.
It's in order, he says, but we're not used to doing
it
that way.
Oh, you changed the order.
Well, geez.
He has
what
no
do you
idea.
Want to do first?
Sorry.
Know what
no. I'm all set. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
CBS has... Okay, let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
There are fans of Jack Benny, the International Jack Benny Fan Club, that got access to CBS's Media Vault... and found a whole bunch of old Jack Benny routines from the 30s. Some old recordings on reel. And they're saying, hey, this is great. You know, and, you know, the copyright's expired. This stuff's in public domain. Let's talk to CBS and say, hey, can we get access to these things and change it to a digital format? Because the original reels are degrading. After, you know, 80 years, it's... You know, it's kind of normal.
Mm-hmm.
And CBS says, well, why don't you talk to the family first? And so the society goes over to the family, and the family's enthusiastic, saying, yes, we'd love if you'd do that. And so they go back to CBS, and CBS says, well, we need to talk to our lawyers. It's just going to be a whole big deal. No.
Did they give a reason? No. Wait, but they have the only copies, right?
Right. They have the only copies.
Okay.
And if – and they are deteriorating. So in 20 years, they may be unrecoverable. They may, you know,
right.
be lost forever. And the thing is, all of these items are in public domain now. The copyright has expired on them. So the reason why they can't just take it from CBS is because the reels themselves, the physical property, is CBS's. So they would have to give permission for that. But mm-hmm. the content within it is public domain.
Right.
CBS couldn't sell it again, per se.
Unless they put a new soundtrack behind it and release it that way.
Right. And some would say, well, maybe it's the cost, except that the Jack Benny fan club was saying, we will convert it for you. Like, we will do all that labor. We will do all of the conversion. We will use our own equipment.
Right.
And yet, CBS still says no, locked it away in the vault, may never be seen again.
That's sad. And a company can just do that. Even though it's in the public domain, they have control over it.
So and just yet, because they have the only copy.
And everybody knows out there who Jack Benny is.
He was... Well, to give a point of reference, he was the person that Johnny Carson considered a role model, a reference.
Who's Johnny Carson?
Yeah, I'm too young for all these people, right?
I wanted to make the young Ben joke, but I just, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I made the young Ben joke before any of you guys could, so.
And didn't he start on radio? Now, you know what radio is, Ben?
Yeah. No, I don't.
But yeah, stand-up comedy, he did a lot of great things. He was the original, you know, host for a show that would do that stand-up routine and interview guests and stuff like that.
So it's like history. We should really
absolutely.
I mean, it's not just a goofball, you know, horrible Three's Company show or something.
And it's not even like you have to find time, you know, in the airwaves today to try to rebroadcast them. It's we're in the digital age. If you convert those reels to a digital format, pop them up on YouTube, anyone who's interested gets to see them.
Yep.
Except CBS won't release them
because they hate us.
They probably actually don't care about us one way or another.
Oh, that just hurts, man. That hurts a lot. All right, this is what's coming up next on Geek Speak. We're going to do a whole discussion about diamonds and oceans and icebergs. And then we're going to talk about, most likely be in the middle of the show, we're going to do a free app for the day for the middle of the show. We're going to talk about old Mac computers. We're going to talk about some spam. We're going to talk about passwords and Flash on the iPhone. So these are things that are coming up in just a moment. But first, I want to throw the floor over to Ben. What is diamond, oceans, and icebergs? Please tell me what's going on here.
Okay, so I just want to talk about liquid diamond. This is, I think, by far the coolest thing I've come across in the last couple of weeks.
Liquid diamonds.
Liquid diamonds, yes. So you can actually melt diamond, contrary to popular belief, because a lot of people know when you heat diamond really, really hot, it turns into graphite. And then you can melt graphite, but you can't melt the diamond, right? And so you have kind of a problem
there. We're talking about, I mean, diamond's just a carbon structure that's a crystalline structure. It's really clear and clean and, mm-hmm. and strong. Mm-hmm. And because of that really strong bond, it's really a very brittle and strong material.
Yeah, yeah. It'll...
And what you're saying is when you heat it up and you break those bonds, it's just going to turn into another carbon form and it will create a structure, and graphite's another one of those structures.
Yeah, but graphite isn't very pretty. It's black, right?
Have you ever seen pencil art? It's beautiful.
Okay, so yeah, we could melt pencils. In any case, so a couple of years ago, some various groups managed to melt diamond. And the way they managed to do that without turning it into graphite is under really, really intense pressures. Like we're talking 40 million atmosphere ATMs, right? Okay. So 40 million times what you experience at sea level.
That's really
wow. That's a lot of pressure, right? And really, 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 really hard to do, right? And because it was all under such intense pressure, you can't really measure the temperature of substances very easily at those pressures. So very recently, this group took 1/10 of a carat of diamond, which is like it's half a millimeter thick of diamond, and they used these lasers in these really high pressures, about 40 million ATM, and they managed to melt this diamond. And a couple things that they noticed. One, they were able to measure the temperature at which the diamond started to resolidify, which is about 50,000 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah, ridiculously hot at about 11 million ATMs. But this is the coolest part. Microscopic diamond icebergs, they saw, were floating in the sea of liquid diamond.
But this was a very small thing.
Very small, very small. That's why they were microscopic icebergs. But the idea is that like there are very, very few substances that will expand when they freeze and contract when they're liquid.
Hence the iceberg.
Water is one of them, and that's why we have ice that floats on top of water, and that's why we have sea life that can survive up in, you know, I don't know, the Arctic Sea and and everything.
What Ben's talking about is when you freeze water. Normally things, as you get colder and colder, they get more and more dense, but the crystalline structure of ice is actually less dense than water.
Tetrahedral lattice.
And therefore it floats, and therefore it's less dense, and therefore it floats in water, and that's why lakes don't freeze solid, because you get an ice cap on a lake, and then it's actually harder to cool, or harder for the heat to get out of the bottom of the liquid, and therefore you've got, I don't know, marine life, and
it's like 35 degrees Fahrenheit underneath the ice.
We probably have a lot less interesting creatures in the ocean if water froze the other direction.
I would guess that we probably wouldn't be here either.
Yeah, and you're saying that Without water operating the way it does?
Yeah.
You're probably right. Water's important to me.
A little.
I drink at least a glass a day. So
some people drink fruit juice, though.
So diamond's the same way?
Yeah, diamond is the same way. There are very few of these substances. One is silicon. Silicon, you know, we use all the time in computers. Bismuth we use in alloys, and that also expands when it solidifies. Antimony and gallium. I don't know how to pronounce that second to last one, but those are all substances that will expand when they solidify, and they get more and more dense as they get colder. But then once they get to that point where they melt at whatever that they freeze at that freezing temperature, then they form that tetrahedral lattice, and then they actually get bigger and float on top of the liquid
cells. Is it possible that at high pressure, like interstellar bodies that are high pressure and have carbon, that's what we have is liquid diamond in them?
Now, that's interesting you'd bring that up, because the next question I was going to ask is, where can we find these? Well, they're hypothesizing that we can find them on Uranus and Neptune.
Why?
Actually, because there's intense pressure there, and down inside of it, these huge, huge planets. So it looks plausible that we actually might have even liquid diamond oceans on these planets, which is awesome. And now that also might explain something else that we've been curious about. Uranus and Neptune, their magnetic field is not similar to ours in that it lines up to the geographic North Pole, right? The magnetic North Pole and the geographic North Pole on Earth mostly line up, right? So if you point a compass, you're going to be pointing probably at the point of rotation.
Mm-hmm.
But with Uranus and Neptune, they can actually be off by up to 60 degrees of the north-south axis, which is like if the magnetic North Pole was in Texas or something, right?
Right.
This is the part I really don't understand, but somehow they're saying that these potential liquid diamond oceans could potentially be the reason that the magnetic fields are so wonky.
Because liquid diamond's wonky?
I guess so, yeah.
That sounds like a band. Liquid diamond's wonky.
Liquid diamond's wonky. Yeah. If the liquid diamond was moving, then it could, I don't know, change the magnet. Anyway, that's where my knowledge breaks down. But how cool is that?
It's very cool.
Like, not only that liquid diamond that solid diamond floats on top of liquid diamond, and solid diamond's kind of heavy, but also that we might actually have it in two of the planets of our solar system.
Right. So. All right. Thank you for the diamond ocean iceberg update. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Al, I'm actually going to – we still have a bit to the middle of the break, so we're going to – let's go ahead and talk about old Macs and reuse them.
We had a call last week from a woman who had a laptop, and she was trying to get it all fixed up. It was an old laptop, old Dell or something. She was trying to get it fixed up for her daughter to use, and had questions. And it, you know, it reminded me of the idea that, you know, there are a lot of old computers out there, and there are better ways of dealing with them instead of filling up landfills. For instance, I have an old iMac.
How old?
It's a G3, so it's running OS 9.
It's one of the candy ones?
It's one of the colorful, remember when they came out, the color red and
pink. They had great commercials with them dancing around.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of those, and they're kind of big, the CRT things. And you can pick
compact
these up.
Compact ray tubes, by the way.
Yeah, CRT. You can.
Cathode ray tubes.
Whatever.
I realized it as soon as I said it.
Wait, that's not compact. Oh, right. Cathode ray.
Well, you can pick these things up for like anywhere from $35 to $150 for a full-blown, you know, iMac.
G3.
Well, you know, like 30. Sure. For us, we're kind of like, yeah, why would you want that? Well, for my kids, for 4-year-old and 7-year-old, really learning computer skills, they don't really need the latest and greatest. And the bottom line is, as computers are changing and things,
the screens are getting flatter and everything's getting lighter, it also is making the computer a lot easier to throw out the window or bring in the bathtub with you or do all the things that a kid can do.
Or spill a drink of water on
it. And these iMacs, you can't even lift them. They have a handle on them, which is, you know, but a kid can't lift these up, and they can tap on the screen and it doesn't like bend or break.
And if it does break somehow, like, you know, a pickaxe to the front, who cares?
Yeah, I mean, then it was like, you know, it was going to happen anyway. But so, and the other thing you say is, well, what can I do with these old machines?
Wait, this thing is, this is like running OS 9, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is anything still working for OS 9?
Yep. You can, everything still runs fine. As a matter of fact, OS 9 is a very zippy OS. I mean, as I use it, I'm like, wow, I remember this, you know, and it's really easy to navigate. And a lot of these machines even still will run OS 10. But my point is that even if they're just an OS 9 machine, you can get a lot of educational software. I just started looking on the web. There's all sorts of companies that sell software that runs on OS 9. It's just there's millions of titles available, all different kinds of, like, the Jumpstart Toddler series and all these different things. Teach them how to count and to read and all that kind of stuff. And I have my kids playing with this thing. They're learning from these CDs. The CDs are cheap. You know, they run, like, sometimes you get them for 99 cents.
Wow.
Up to, like, you know, $25 or something.
Sure.
But they're, you know, they're a whole application that runs. And
so repurpose your older iMacs for kids.
Yeah. And or even a PC or whatever. I mean, sure. The thing is, instead of throwing them in the landfill or, you know, doing whatever, if you have kids, they really don't need the latest and greatest to get the computer skills. They can do it from any old thing. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is still totally usable. I mean, we don't have to just dump it in a landfill because it's a couple years old.
Very cool. Thank you very much. Miles, it is your turn. I was going to cover, we only have a few more minutes to the break, but spam.
Actually,
this system of organizing is not working, right?
Right, it's not.
What do you think was next?
Well, the thing is, I also hit refresh. That's what I'm seeing. So I'm seeing a different sort of list than you are. I wanted to cover Shay Bloxton, 15-year-old sophomore at Nicholas County High School in Somersville, West Virginia. She's also a participant in a project in which students analyzed data from the radio telescope there at the Robert C. Byrd Green Bank Telescope and spotted evidence in the data of a pulsar on October 15th. So Bloxton, along with National Radio Astronomy Observatory astronomers, observed the object again 1 month later.
What's a pulsar?
A pulsar is a neutron star that is spinning rapidly. So after a star goes nova, or goes supernova, rather, its outside sheath is blown away, and the rest of the material then gets sucked down to a very dense core. And it's so dense that protons and electrons start to merge into neutrons. So dense that a star that's larger than our sun, let's say has, after the supernova, has the same mass as our sun, would be about the size of, say, Santa Cruz.
That's really, really small.
That's really,
and dense,
really small.
And no offense to Santa Cruz.
Yes.
But what was really great about this was anyone, if they have access to the data, go through that, they can find this. This is a 15-year-old sophomore in high school.
Wow.
Went looking through the data, discovered a pulsar.
I think I was
pulsar
playing
being,
Space Invaders.
Right. A neutron, I didn't finish. A pulsar is a neutron star that's rapidly spinning, so you end up with these jets of energy going off at opposite sides, and it's spinning rapidly, so it ends up looking like a lighthouse in the sky, these flashes of light, and
right.
They were only discovered in the mid-60s.
And it's specifically, you have to be in line with its rotation,
right.
Without its, yeah, in its rotation to actually get the pulse. And they're very regular. It's a great way to determine how, to help determine the movement of interstellar bodies, because when you have a pulsar doing its thing, you know the beat that it has.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool.
It may be anywhere from fractions of a second to 8 seconds, I believe, is the upper range.
Yeah, yeah.
For that pulse to occur.
Okay, very cool. So this guy's 15.
She.
Sorry,
she.
This girl is
this
15.
Girl.
Shay, okay. Very cool, thank you. All right, well, we're in the mid-break, so let me do that. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. We are not taking your calls today. That's because we appreciate Well, I appreciate all the people here in the air room and just want to hear them talk. Actually, it's because Rick's taking a break, and therefore we don't have a phone answer, which is fine because we have so much wonderful news to cover today. So I'm not going to give out the phone numbers, but I will let you know that KOSP is co-sponsoring the 14th Annual Gail Rich Awards Tuesday night, January 26th at 7:30 p.m. at the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz. I guess it's moved this year to the Rio to get big. Cool. Each year, the Gail Rich Awards honor outstanding artists and leaders in the arts community. Admission is free. For more information, visit the Cultural Council of Santa Cruz County at ccscc.org. That's Cultural Council of Santa Cruz County. It's a flash from my past. The first ever, I guess 14 years ago, Gail Rich Awards, I was one of the winners, which is pretty cool. Actually, my whole family was. And Gail was a wonderful woman. We all miss her still. If you want to go to that event, that's the 14th, the 14th annual, January 26th, 7:30 p.m. That's Tuesday at the Rio. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by the University of Advancing Technology, offering master's degree programs for geeks to become innovators of the future. Classes now forming for January. uat.edu/masters. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, we have Al Luckow, Miles Elam, and Ben Jaffe. We're covering the geek news, and normally in the middle of the break, we do a recommendation of a podcast, but instead, have an iPhone app update kind of thing. Al?
Oh, yeah. There's a website called Free App A Day, and it's at freeappaday.com.
And you can get to that by going to geekspeak.org.
Yep. And this site, they've only been going since mid-January. And what they're doing is every day they're featuring a new free iPhone app. There's a lot of free apps out there for those who don't have iPhones. You can get a lot of these things free. And so it's a showcase for developers to get their products out there. Mm-hmm. And
How do they find the submissions? People submit through them?
People submit to them. It's really because I think when you're in iTunes, you're relying on maybe Apple to feature you, which
right.
They don't really feature too many. So if you want to get some publicity, it's kind of difficult unless you've got some awesome game. So... Or
some awesome connections.
Or whatever, yeah, some connections. So this site is representing one of those types of things, and it's all free. So
right.
You go
they
there.
They only recommend the free ones. Okay.
And so every 24 hours, they come up with a new free iPhone app that you can download and install in your
And
phone.
Fill up that storage space
and
on your phone.
Fill it all up if you're one of those people that just wants to have lots of apps. I mean, you can.
You know, I have so many apps on my phone, I can't even find the stuff I need.
I couldn't believe.
I only use the first screen. Just
when I saw your phone, I was like, oh my God. There's like screen after screen of apps. And but I guess you can do that.
That's what happens when you're a new media professional. You know? Oh, wait, you are too.
There's a lot of things you can do with these things. So.
That's true.
Yeah. And this site is new, so there aren't a lot of things in the app. They have a page called Apps Hall of Fame.
You know, so you could start now and kind of be on top of every single one.
It's
just get a really big phone.
I think January 18th they started.
So. All right. Thank you very much for that. The spam update.
A recent report by the European Network and Information Security Agency says that 5% of email is not spam.
No.
95%. This was of the European Union. This was not done in the United States. But it does cover 100 ISPs from many different countries,
mm-hmm.
Including most of the European Union member states. And it covers a total of about 80 million mailboxes.
Wow.
And what they found were things
like... How do they determine, with 80 million mailboxes, how are they determining if it's spam or not?
I'm sure they're just going off of their spam catchers. So, yes,
okay,
there's some false positives.
So
but considering the volume
it's
there...
It's a little bit blurry line, but it doesn't matter that much. It
yeah.
might be 92%. All right. Okay, so that's really sad.
Probably wouldn't... The margin of error probably wouldn't be that...
No, bad, I'm just saying that, worst case, it's still extremely high. So let's say it's 94%
right.
to 96%.
And it says, among the very small providers, a quarter of those ISPs allocate anti-spam budgets of about $10,000 per year.
Wow.
Which, 10,000 euro per year, which is about $14,000 per year.
So that's for them to combat the spam so that their users can actually use the services?
Right.
Wow.
Which is a competitive advantage for them, but it's just this.
So spam does cost money.
Oh, yes.
You know, it makes you wonder, are people actually clicking on these things?
Yes.
Some people are.
I mean,
you get
how can
one person, you send out a million pieces of spam, one person responds, you've already recouped your costs for spamming.
That's the
that's
lure
not
then.
Good.
I
don't like that. Let's fix that.
I know.
Can there be a technical solution for that problem?
Yeah, they're called spam filters.
That's the technical solution. Can we do a bureaucratic?
Well, you know, there is the ultimate. There is the ultimate spam filter, which is a lot of these services where you enter in who you want to receive emails from, and then if the person that emails you isn't one of those people, they get an email back that says, "Hi, I noticed you've emailed me, but I have a spam filter that's stopping everybody I don't know. If you think you know me, enter your name here."
Mm-hmm. Right,
and then,
whitelisting.
And so basically you're saying you're a real person, and then you have the opportunity to add them to your thing. So that is – there's some Spam Arrest, I think, does that. Or,
yeah, there's a few of them.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. And that – it's a little bit irritating.
It's extremely irritating when you're sending mail.
Yeah. But and then also when you get things from like Amazon, oh, your product is shipped, you know, and it's like you want to get that stuff. So there's that technical problem.
I used to have a desire to get rid of my spam because it was so frustrating for me. Mm-hmm. And I've just done two things. One is I've accepted that some email I won't get because it'll go in my spam filter.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing, because I'm not even checking my spam filter anymore. I used to check my spam, you know, the things that get
caught.
Same
here.
I don't check anymore.
Same here.
If it gets in there, I'm sorry. Format your messages better.
Yep.
Second thing is I just forward all my mail to my Gmail account. And Google is really good at auto-detecting spam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd say they're excellent because I just don't get that much spam.
Yeah.
Miles, you for the
season? I see spam very rarely. It'll be this short little surge for 1 or 2 days, and then I won't see anything for another few months.
Right, because they fix the filters.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I just trust Big Brother. Everything's fine with that, right?
Yeah.
Google's not evil.
Yeah, there are some other technologies that would help with it. Center Policies Framework actually has some issues, but there's... now I've forgotten the name of the technology.
The delayed one?
No, it was originally... No, the gray listing is the one we were talking about. And that did work for us, but...
That was amazing.
Sender ID, I think I want to say.
Oh, so like a real technical solution.
Yeah, it was originally published by Yahoo.
Just tattoo a number on everybody's arm, and then they have to use that number for sending email?
It actually goes through DNS. Someone publishes their DNS records a public key, and then you sign...
sign your outgoing mail through your mail domain name service with your private key, and then you can authenticate it with your – I see.
Exactly.
So you're basically saying it did come from them. This email address was the sender.
Right, which solves the problem with forgeries, which means that you don't get emails that seem to come from your bank. It would actually flag as something different.
Right.
But unfortunately, most people haven't implemented that.
Do banks actually send emails? I mean, the thing is, if there's an official thing – you know, I tell my mom this. You know, if you ever get anything from like the IRS or the bank and they email you – just don't even look at
it. Especially the IRS.
Mm-hmm. They don't email you. I never get any emails from my bank. I mean, I get
emails from my bank.
Do you?
Yeah, I get two.
Because I do a lot of payment online.
But so an official email that requires your action.
No.
You know?
No.
You get notification of something happening, but never
right. And here's the other thing is I do not click in anything in the email. If I get an email from my bank, I then go to my website of my bank. I do not click on the email.
Right.
And I'm a pretty technical person, I would say. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's actually really hard to determine whether it's from them or not.
If you hover over the link sometimes, at least I know in mail, it'll give you a little tooltip, a little yellow box, and it'll say the actual URL, and it'll have some crazy whacked out...
Right, lots of times the links are not very good.
You can
forge that
probably
too.
Even mask that.
It's pretty.
Yeah. So basically, don't click in an email to launch a website when it's a security website.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of these issues or trying to deal with it are based upon DNS, and DNS is really
not really
insecure.
Yeah,
there's a solution: DNS secure, DNSSEC.
Yeah, but it's not there yet.
It is there. People just aren't implementing it.
Oh, and basically what Miles is saying is like the general backbone of the internet is not secure at all.
Well, it's not so much that. Like working with different businesses is absolutely secure, but imagine that the phone book could be hacked.
Right. That's what it is that you can modify the phone book on the fly. So you look up, I'm going to call Al. And I look up the phone book and I get a number and surreptitiously Miles has slipped a new page in the phone book and actually it's Ben's number. And that's how this DNS security vulnerability
is. And I'm a really malicious person. Yeah.
Right. And you answer the phone, you sound like Al.
And I give him a virus through the phone, right?
And then you tell me...
This is where the metaphor breaks down, but yes.
Right, right. And then I give you my password, which is really strongly, it's a really detailed, complicated password.
And I can't remember it.
All passwords are like that, right? Right, Ben?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, actually, it's a very, very distressing state of affairs. So back in December, some hackers stole and published 33 million passwords from the website rockyou.com, and it was an SQL injection vulnerability that they used, and the database was apparently unencrypted as well. So that's all, well, I was going to say that's all well and good. That's not well and good at all, but that's better than what this actually shows. When you look at these 33 million passwords, the most popular password used on that website was 123456.
Excellent.
The second most popular.
That's the same combination I have on my luggage.
Ooh, Spaceballs. All right. Oh. Thanks, Miles.
Very nice. Very nice. The second most popular password was 12345.
Wait, what was the first one for?
123456.
Oh.
I see.
Well, most password.
That one's more complicated.
Yeah.
Third one?
The third one was, strangely enough, 123456 87. I think that's a I think that's a typo. I think it's supposed to be 123456 78, but I'm not sure.
So those listening, if you're typing in those passwords,
stop and change them.
You're in the
90th
percentile of people.
Yes. If you're driving, pull over, write a note on your forehead.
And
change it when you get
pull over, whip out your iPhone.
Here's
and
the
fix
thing, guys,
it right now.
Look at the website we're talking about. We're talking about UROC. What is it?
No, rockyou.com.
Rockyou.com.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, somebody else got access to my account. And what is it? Just music?
I don't know.
It doesn't matter, right?
I don't think it matters because ultimately the problem is the passwords that people are using, right? The next popular password was password. The next popular password was I love you. After that was princess, and then was rock you, which is the title of the website that you're typing in the password for.
Well, you won't forget
so
it that way.
This is a problem.
Yeah, this is absolutely a problem because people don't have multiple passwords most of the time. They use a single password for all of their sites.
Exactly.
Don't a lot of people have a couple passwords? Like they have their banking password and then they have their throwaway password, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
Sometimes.
Is that sometimes.
How it works? No?
Mm. We do.
Here's the thing. This is what you need to do. You can't have a password unique, a unique password for every site. That's impossible. There's too many out there, right?
I don't think you have to have a couple levels. No. There are two ways.
Wait, one, you do an algorithm. It doesn't help either.
One, you do an algorithm that's difficult for people to get. Okay. They need multiple data points.
Wait. Difficult for people to get. That doesn't mean your algorithm is hard for a computer to get.
No.
Your algorithm with Idea Ben is fun, but does not effectively work.
No, it does. It does if you only have one of my passwords. Yeah, it does if you only have one of my passwords or two.
What Ben is talking about is that he has a general concept of a password, right? And then every site he visits, he takes elements of where he is and mixes it with it in a pattern that only he knows, and then that's the password he gets. So theoretically, I think if you gave me one password for a site, I might be able to figure it out.
I don't think so. I mean, combine that with shifting letters and
Ben, here's the trick with security. This is the trick with security. You don't think so. But see, there's always someone smarter than you that does think so.
Here's what I'm saying.
Isn't that one of the concepts of security?
No. But the only point I'm making is that I have unique passwords for each site. I'm not saying that given half of my passwords, you couldn't figure out the rest of them. I'm saying that that makes me a very difficult target compared to people who use the words or the passwords 123456 or password. I mean, same with Wi-Fi points, right? Your wireless access point key doesn't have to be very complex. It just needs to be there because then people will target people who have open networks, you know, or who have the default passwords. As long as your password's not the default password, that makes it a little bit better.
So here's the thing is if you – Miles, go ahead.
There was another complication to this, which is more and more we're moving to things like Google – your Google email address and password are your one login and password, or Facebook Connect, which has been showing up a lot more often. One password controls everything. It's not even so much you have the same password for multiple sites. You have one password that – specifically controls all access to all sites.
Yeah. Right.
All like with a password manager, a lot of times what you have is you have one password which unlocks you to all of your other passwords, and you can just type in your one password to log into anything. And I think that's a good solution mainly because it's local, and if you have a really strong password, then that's...
As long as you don't lose that...
You just don't lose that password. But to... Okay, Lyle's giving us signs.
So anyway, a couple
more really quick facts.
Can we give a recommendation for people how to make a good password?
You can use a random password generator. They're all over the place, and that will give you,
write it down.
But that'll give you a pronounceable password. And if you just memorize that once, then you have one very strong password you can use for your bank.
That's the most important thing, take stuff that has to do with your finances and your ability for people to steal money from you easily. Make that password very difficult, and you can make it uniform across multiple sites if you trust each one of them to keep it safe. Yeah. And then other sites that aren't important, like logging into Yahoo to take a look at things, or even something like Netflix, where they can't really get money from you, but they could change your queue order. You want a lighter password.
They can also change your address, the shipping address.
Yeah. So. No, you have to put your password in. Yeah, that's true.
If you have to deal with money, have a secure password.
I'd say have three.
Choose something better than 123456, but you can have something easier to remember.
I'd say use three different passwords. Use a highly secure one, which is your banking information. Use one that's like Netflix, where the worst case they could do is order more service for you or change your address on your account, and you'd catch it. You're not going to be liable for your entire bank savings.
Well, they could also change the password right afterwards, and then the person can't get back in.
The thing that I'm saying is that there's the security. All of them you should keep safe and be clear, but don't mix them all. You don't want what your bank account is to also be your Netflix account, because it's possible that Netflix security is not as good as, and you get, Netflix is a bad example, but some online shopping center that has your credit card on file. They might not be saving your password in a good way on their database, and some upset employee can go ahead and dump all that data, or a MySQL injection can get that password. And then if that's grabbed and it's the same as your bank, you're really in trouble. Right. You need to make your bank environment be like super secure, then your other stuff be relatively secure, and then you need a throwaway password, which really isn't a big deal. You can tell, your spouse about that other password. Of course, you probably tell your spouse about every password if you're sharing accounts and stuff. Anyway, a couple other facts.
A couple quick facts. 123456 was used in 290,000 out of 33 million.
Nice.
Which is a little under 1%. So if you were a hacker and you were trying to do a brute force attack of this particular website,
you'd like to try it 100 times.
Yeah. one attempt would guess 0.9% of the users. So one success per 111 attempts, which means some back of the envelope calculations that the people who wrote this article said that you could gain access to one new account every second, or just 17 minutes to compromise 1,000 accounts. I mean, it depends on, I guess, the speed of, but in any case, it's really a bad situation.
Which also means for web developers, if just because your public facing site is secured, if your users have access to stuff, you need to be able to lock down the individual user, the authenticated users as well, so they don't have privileges that you don't expect them to have.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you can't trust that it's actually a user that's paying you for you.
And the other thing you can do is put CAPTCHAs on the sites. So there's always slow down brute forcing, because then the computers have to get through the CAPTCHAs.
CAPTCHAs are...
What is it saying for?
I'm not going to guess this time because I messed up on the acronym.
Go Lyle, no. There's little images where they show you letters, and they're kind of distorted in a way, and you have to type in those letters. And the reason is that humans are really good at undistorting pictures, whereas computers aren't nearly as good.
Well, weren't as good. They're getting better and better. What is CAPTCHA?
They're still not
stand
as good.
For?
I've long since
computer
forgotten.
It's a Turing test, basically. Okay. Thank you very much, Ben, for that.
Indeed.
And Al, it's your turn. Tell us about some cool gear, like an airplane or something, please.
Oh, the airplane deal. That's funny. You didn't have that listed in the list here.
No, this list isn't working. We're going back to the system next week. This is a disaster.
Wow, man. Well, anyway, there is a thing that is, it's like a jet ski for the air. And I'm always into these rocket-powered things. You put your arms out like that, and I should have known what you were doing.
I was trying to make a flying airplane gesture with my arm. You know what? CAPTCHA stands for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart.
But only some of those words are capitalized,
right?
So only some of them count.
Completely Automated Public Turing
Test to
Computers,
tell.
Humans Apart.
Yeah, Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart. Like that.
You didn't do the and.
Oh, yeah, you're right. And. And.
And Turing is a scientist and computer scientist before computers invented the idea of computers, basically, and
electronic computers,
and popularized the idea that this Turing test is if you made a computer sufficient enough to trick humans into thinking that it's human or has a consciousness, doesn't it have a consciousness? Meaning that we don't actually know other people have consciousness, unless they interact in such a way that we believe they think like us. And so if a computer did the same thing, we would have to prescribe intelligence and consciousness to that computer, even though we might not believe that that's the case from some other level. That's the only way we could tell is by our own emotional impact. That's how I know, for example, that Al is a human and Al is now going to tell me about an airplane.
Well, I don't even know what I did with that story.
If you go to geekspeak.org, it's the third to the last story currently on the webpage for today's show.
To buy time, CAPTCHA is based on the word capture, and it's a contrived acronym. Kind of like Patriot, the Patriot Act.
Right? Oh, I see.
So contrived. So they made it fit that word.
Okay.
So as they made opposed the word to, and they, yeah, okay, they
that's
made
good. Nice fill. Nice fill.
Oh yeah, this yeah. thing. I know what this is now. Yeah, I proposed this story like a month ago, and you just kept ignoring it. And I thought, well, maybe he doesn't want to hear about this. I don't know.
I don't. Actually, the show's over.
this particular plane, though, this is a interesting plane. It's one of those small kind of, not an ultralight, but it looks like a regular plane, but it's electric. It goes like an hour and a half to 3 hours. I guess that might have to do something with how much wind there is, and obviously it's very quiet, but it's an amazing thing. It's called a Unique, Y-U-N-E-E-C, Unique.
Unique.
You know, the Unique E 430 electric plane, and this is supposed to be available in 2011, and they've got them flying around now. That you can see, we have a link to them on the website, and they're flying around now. The thing you're thinking of, it only goes 3 hours maximum, so that's kind of a little bit awkward. It has a 25-to-1 glide ratio, so if you run out of power in the sky, you can just glide down.
And hopefully you're...
I guess.
I like that idea. The engineer's like, well, it's got glide time. Yeah. What happens if you run out of battery? Well, it has glide time.
It's a battery-powered plane, so it doesn't use any fuel, so it's not polluting the skies. So that was the other thing about it. And it's relatively the same cost as any small aircraft. Mm-hmm. It looks like it fits about two people in it. It's got really low noise, whisper quiet, they say. And it's emissions free. So this is something that you might start seeing more of, electric planes. And you can watch it fly around.
From geekspeak.org. It's very cool. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for that, Al. Ben, real quick mention.
Real quick mention. If you're running OS 10, do your updates. There's a security update, which is considered a critical security update. So go ahead and click the little apple at the top of the screen. Click security update. Install the security update.
Software update.
Sorry.
And then...
Yes.
Thank you very much. Speaking of security updates.
And the IE flaw that bit Google and 33 other firms recently in China, that flaw has been patched. Microsoft put an out of an emergency patch up on Thursday morning. By all means, get it. But it turns out that there is an exploit that's already in the wild. It means that this is just in general use, not just targeting those particular firms, but actually hitting people in general, virus going around. So it's very important that you switch it over. This affects Internet Explorer 6, 7, and 8, although the recent exploit was only 6. So very important that you update it. The really sad part about it.
Or switch to Google Chrome,
or switch
Chrome,
to
maybe?
Chrome or Firefox or Opera or Safari.
No, Chrome, because then you can do the really cool Google Gravity thing.
And the really sad part about this is that Microsoft has been aware of this flaw since September.
Oh, you're kidding.
But it wasn't
me.
Until...
And it's being taken advantage of and people are getting affected.
Right, but because it became public, now it's
that just
being
really
pushed to go
ticks
forward.
Me
now
off.
It's important, right?
Well, there's something to be said for that, but yeah.
I want to mention the great Australian internet blackout. Australia government is going into this realm of deciding that it's time to start filtering the content on the internet. At least that's this website, internetblackout.com.au, describes. I haven't read the other side of it, but it looks like a pretty supported idea that you want to stop the Australian government from doing this filtering. And so there's been this motion to add black profile pages, images to your profiles for different services, make the web page actually black, basically to bring attention to this issue. And we've seen this kind of thing when geeks dislike something, they kind of make a movement to modify websites and modify the services we see in such a way to bring awareness to it. And this is just another one of those. And you can learn more about that from the geekspeak.org site. What time is it, Al?
Hey, there's this neat thing I ran across. It's called the Geek Clock. And instead of numbers, each one of the numbers has like a formula in there. And so if you're a real big math whiz, it's pretty complicated looking. I mean,
can you give some examples of the formulas?
Well, one of them is, well, for number two, it's a representation of B. Can you read that? B1L or something? It's a joke in the math world. Where, you know, one guy goes into a bar and he orders a beer. The next guy comes in, orders half a beer. The third guy orders a quarter of a beer. And the bartender says, you're all jokers, and pours two beers.
Right.
So that's the two. But then a couple of them, number three is a Unicode character, XML, a numerical character reference. Number five is a golden mean. Number six is three factorial. Three times two times one equals six. There's just all these weird things. So it's like you look at the clock, and it looks like a regular round clock, but it's got all these formulas on it. It's kind of good for a geek.
It's very cool.
So if you're not a math person, you don't have to go through the equations because it's an analog clock.
Right, analog clock with 12 numbers. You know the number. It actually kind of tells you what the formula is.
Yeah.
So two to the negative power of one mod seven is four.
Right. I mean, it's a conversation piece, but it's a great geek thing.
You got to get that for Waz. He'd like that.
Oh, he would like that.
You should buy it for him.
Yeah.
All right. Because he doesn't have money, right?
Yeah.
All right. Man, we got more time on the show. Miles, you want to talk about Haiti? Ben, you don't have another story, do you?
I have a brief story, which is that NASA has extended the World Wide Web out into space. So astronauts now have the internet. Fortunately, they've got a lot to do, so fortunately they're not going to be surfing YouTube.
And nothing's getting done up there now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just everything has come to a screeching halt.
So Astro TJ, which is TJ Kramer, he's a flight engineer up there, and he made the first use of the system and tweeted. So from space. So previously you've had tweets from space, but they've been emailed to the ground and then support personnel have posted them to the Twitter account. In this case, he actually went on the site and tweeted from space.
Cool. Thank you. Real quick mention of Haiti.
Ham radio operators in the Dominican Republic were trying to install repeaters in Haiti, try to get some emergency communication going on. Same thing happened during 9/11. You had ham radio operators coming out and handling some emergency response.
Right.
That's the whole point behind that amateur radio movement, is that they play around with it, and then when an emergency strikes, they're the first responders.
Great. Thank you very much for that. Coming up next is Car Talk. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
Hi, this is Al Luckow. If you're like me, sometimes while working at your computer, you feel, I don't know, uncomfortable. Now, we all know there could be a number of causes for this, but I'm here to tell you that I think I know what it is. I think it's because your eyeballs are cold. Yes, cold eyeballs are a huge problem, not just here in our little town, but all over the world. Even in the tropics, a strong breeze, timed at the right moment, can make your eyeballs cold. Well, lucky for us, there's a USB product that addresses this worldwide dilemma. It's the Compact Impact USB Eye Warmer. Yes, an eyeball warmer that plugs into your USB port. It comes with a 4-foot USB cable, and as far as I can tell, you can only get them in brown. You can't see when you have these on, so I think you're supposed to just sit there until your eyeballs become sufficiently warm. Yes, it's real. Link up at geekspeak.org.